You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our next guest says his band Black Violin is helping kids figure out what they're passionate about and how to do it their own way.
First, Wisconsin is trying to turn the tide on the growing problem of heroin and opioid drug addiction. While a lot of the effort is focused on prevention, there are concerns about access to addiction treatment.
Behavioral therapy and mental health care can be key parts of the road to recovery for people dealing with addiction, and addiction experts say prescription medications can play a huge role in successful treatment.
But access to those drugs can be very limited. Our next guest looks at some of the obstacles to getting medications for addiction.
Scott Gordon joins us now. He reports for WisContext, and his piece on medications and addiction is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
How important are medications in treating opioid addiction?
Well, in a way, they are maybe less important than a lot of people in the substance abuse and mental health profession would like them to be. These medications do have a lot of evidence on their side, a lot of medical research that shows that they're effective. But for example, the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration considers them underused. And, when we talk about treatment with medication, we're really talking about something that the profession calls medication-assisted treatment, which means that you're combining the medication with, behavioral treatment, therapy, and other things. So it's never just the medication alone.
What are the medications we're talking about here?
Basically, there's three big categories. The first is methadone, which is the oldest. The second is buprenorphine, which some people know in a proprietary formulation called Suboxone. And then there's naltrexone, which is the most recent drug to be approved for treatment of opioid addiction.
Those first two are opioid derivatives themselves, right? And the last one is Vivitrol, I think, is the brand name, and that's not an opioid at all.
That's correct. Methadone and buprenorphine are both opioids themselves, so they're regulated a bit differently. And Vivitrol is not an opioid. That's one formulation of naltrexone, and it's a once-a-month injection.
And you write that there's stigma, ongoing stigma, surrounding the idea of using medication. Some people say you're using drugs to defeat a drug addiction. Is that stigma still out there?
It is. I think the biggest kind of talking point that people bring up about medication-assisted treatment is this notion that it substitutes one addiction for another. And the problem with that statement is if you look at it from the perspective of, people in the medical profession, that's really just not true. People using these treatment drugs might form a physical dependence, but physical dependence and addiction are not necessarily the same thing. And the whole way in which a course of medication is given and managed is going to be completely different from using heroin or prescription opioids or other things that you're getting under, obviously much less regulated circumstances.
Right. The alternative might be a very finely calculated dose of something from a doctor's office versus a street drug, which may have any kind of dosage, any kind of additives or adulterants, a very high overdose risk, that kind of thing.
Right. And of course, one of the big overdose risks for heroin users of late is that there are much more powerful opioids mm-hmm. being mixed into the supply of heroin, including fentanyl, which is the culprit in a lot of overdose tests recently.
Let's get into access to these medications in Wisconsin. You write that there are a lot of hurdles here, and one of those is different regulations for how these drugs are used, prescribed, available, that kind of thing.
Right. So each of the three categories that I mentioned before of opioid treatment drugs exists under a different set of rules. For methadone, you have to go physically to a methadone clinic to get it and, build up take-home privileges over time. For Suboxone, doctors can prescribe it to patients through their offices, but because it's an opioid and because of some kind of arcane laws that exist around opioids, they have to get a special waiver from the DEA that limits the number of patients they can prescribe it to. And with Vivitrol and other naltrexone drugs, it's a little bit easier, and there are a little fewer hurdles. Again, because it's not an opioid, so the law treats it very differently.
And these are not conveniently available very often. You wrote that methadone clinics, the furthest north one in Wisconsin, do I have this right? It's in Wausau?
That's correct. And the state is...
And for people who don't know Wisconsin geography, there's a lot of north left after Wausau.
Yeah, there is. And there's a couple of interesting points with that. It used to be under state regulations that if you were getting methadone, you had to live within 50 miles of the methadone clinic. That rule has been relaxed under this new slate of opioid-related legislation that Representative John Nygren and other folks have championed. But the fact remains that kind of even if you're within 50 miles, that might be really difficult to manage while pulling your life back together,
right,
and likely not having a lot of money. And the state is trying to create opioid treatment programs in those sort of neglected northern areas of the state. And that's a newer effort, and they're finding that there's greater demand for it than they expected. And those programs are explicitly not using methadone. So which shows you, there's still an attitude out there that methadone is a bad option.
Talking to Scott Gordon with WisContext about medication treatment for heroin and other opioid drug addiction. Now, we go to see our general practitioner if we're dealing with an addiction. Are they trained? Do they know what they can prescribe? Do they know what the options are out there?
One of the big surprises for me in reporting this story is that some of the doctors out there are confused about what they can and can't do or what requirements they need to meet in order to be able to prescribe something like Suboxone or like Vivitrol. There are different certifications and hoops they might need to jump through. And some of the doctors themselves are kind of intimidated and confused by all that. And there are folks in the medical profession in the state working to help doctors understand that a little better. Another piece that I found interesting is that in Wisconsin, substance abuse counselors and mental health counselors are treated under different sets of regulations. And so if you're a duly licensed counselor or a duly licensed facility and you're trying to provide that kind of well-rounded, holistic treatment that I mentioned earlier, then you kind of are left wondering which set of regulations you're obeying at any given time, and they are different on a lot of important points.
Yeah, it sounds like the best case would be a person could get behavioral therapy, maybe mental health treatment, and medication. Is there any sort of thing that's a one-stop shop where somebody could go to one place and get all of that?
There are duly licensed clinics. There are methadone clinics that would like to be duly licensed, and there are some hurdles to that. But one thing that's been talked about a lot is how can people create a better structure to connect a given patient with all these different pieces. One thing that I looked at in my story is this set of flowcharts that is given to patients in the Madison area who are trying to figure out how to start treatment depending on what their insurance situation is and what their needs are. And, going through that it's kind of crazy to look at it. It's like it would be really overwhelming to kind of figure that out on a good day, not to mention if you're in this position in your life when you're recovering from opioid addiction.
Are there efforts in the state to make access to these medications easier, more available?
Yes. And like I said, those efforts, at least from the legislature's mm-hmm. perspective, definitely favor drugs like Suboxone and Vivitrol. The Department of Corrections has a pilot program going on with Vivitrol for recently released and soon to be released inmates. And, there is a lot of hope placed on drugs like Suboxone and Vivitrol that they can sort of help deal with those geographic hurdles because they're not tethered to a specific clinic location by law.
That's on the state side. Is the medical community trying to navigate this too?
Yes. And, another thing that a lot of people told me when I was reporting this story is that for a long time, the medical community hasn't treated addiction like a priority. And, someone pointed out to me, if you went to medical school and you never had a professor who knew about addiction and talked to you about it, that might breed kind of a certain ignorance that kind of sticks with you throughout your career. So people are making more steps within the profession and within med schools to put a bit more of an emphasis on it, have more training and certification for it and things of that nature.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rob.
That was Scott Gordon with WisContext. His piece on opioid addictions is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our next guests are both classically trained musicians who fuse classical music with hip-hop influences for a style that's known as what they call classical boom.
They've collaborated with Wu-Tang Clan, Alicia Keys, and Wyclef Jean, and shared the stage with Aerosmith, Kanye West, and Tom Petty. But not everyone they make music with is famous. A big part of their mission is to reach out to students to show them what it looks like to bust a stereotype. Here is the group Black Violin and their piece, Stereotypes.
Often unfair and untrue belief that many people have about
all four things with a particular characteristic are the same.
Stereotype, an unfair and untrue belief
that many people have about
other people or things.
Stereotype, a standardized mental picture that is held in.
Pueden predecir el comportamiento de una persona basada en su raza o nivel social. Estereotipo.
Marcus joins us now. He plays the violin in the duo Black Violin with violist Will B, and they're playing at the Widener Center for the Performing Arts in Green Bay this Sunday at 7:30 p.m. Kev, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we just heard the piece Stereotypes. Can you tell us what this one's about?
Stereotypes is just sort of like, you know, our life, I would say. You know, I'm a 6'2" black guy that's been playing classical violin for as long as I can remember. And you know, the song kind of, it spurred from an airport trip, and we're walking through an airport, and people always ask us what's in our case, you know? And then we say, oh, you know, they think, oh, trombone, is it a keyboard, what is it? And when we say violin, most of the time they're like, wow, I would have never thought that that was a violin in your case, because, I mean, we're built like athletes, we're built like, you know, football players and basketball players. And but, you know, we're a classically trained violinist. So that idea has always been something that follows us about don't judge a book by its cover and, you know, always try to do things that people aren't expecting and always try to break stereotypes because it's a bit more satisfying that way. So when we were making this new album, you know, we had that in mind, and Stereotypes is the title song of our album, Stereotypes. And that's basically what we were thinking with it. It's just like, you know, don't judge a book by its cover and always try to break stereotypes. If someone says violin ain't cool, you should do it. And, you know, that gives you reason, more reason to do it anyway. So always try to break stereotypes and don't let that define you.
Does that bug you when you get that airport question, what's in your case, and then the surprise? Or do you view it as an opportunity to change someone's mind, maybe educate somebody?
Yeah, I love it. It's my favorite thing about playing the violin is that I'm not supposed to do it. And, you know, it's just, yeah, I love that, you know, every time that happens, you know, we get to change people's perceptions of what is possible. And we do it every single night on stage where we come out, people come out just to see, okay, violin, hip hop, interesting. I want to see what this is. And they come out and they have no idea what to expect. And after everything is said and done, hopefully they're looking at the violin in a different perspective. They're looking at who can play it, what kind of music can happen from the violin, what else can mix together, what else can be done that I never thought was possible. And that's sort of the thought process that we go for when we perform and when we're making our music.
Now, it sounds like when you were a kid, this was not the life that you necessarily thought you were going to lead. You got a great story about how you played the violin for the first time, how you wound up with this life. Can you tell us how that happened?
Well, you know, I started in the fifth grade because my mom made me do it. you know, most people start that way. I kind of was really good at it from the beginning. It was always something that came naturally to me. And I went to a performing arts middle school where I played in the orchestra every day, second period. Then I went to a performing arts high school, and that's where Will and I met. And we were stand partners in orchestra class. That's how we met. And, you know, every day, second period, just playing there. And, you know, the violin and the viola just always kept giving us more options and more opportunities. We ended up studying for free at, you know, state schools in Florida. I went to Florida International University. Will went to Florida State. After that, we sent the tape to Showtime at the Apollo when we just started mixing classical and hip-hop. And Apollo's like the longest-running talent competition in the world. And, you know, Michael Jackson, James Brown, you know, it's been going for 80 years. They boo you off the stage if they don't like you. And we went on that stage, and we won everything. And we won $20,000 and became 2005 Apollo champions. And then doors just kept opening, you know. The more that we were able to think different about the violin, use the training, but also be influenced by who we are and what we listen to as far as hip-hop and popular music and reggae and everything else we listen to, and fuse it together in a way that, you know, doesn't lose a classical purist but doesn't lose someone that listens to Drake and Katy Perry every day, then that's when we found that, you know, people would respond to it. So we always, since then, have been trying to craft that and find different ways to really be extremely classical but also be very pop at the same time without going too far either way. And it's been an amazing journey since then. You know, Apollo, then we toured with Alicia Keys, we toured with Linkin Park, played Broadway, toured for our troops in Iraq, played at the inauguration for President Obama, and just, you know, it's been a whirlwind, and it's because we're thinking about things in a different perspective and just looking at things in a way that most people aren't. And that's why the concert's really interesting, and that's why our music is really interesting, because it's everything that you like, but you've never really had it together at the same time.
Yeah, back in the early days, did people get what you were doing? On the one hand, you were doing this fusion of classical music and then hip-hop styles. On the other hand, it sounds like club owners were like, what do you mean two black guys are going to come in and play classical music? What were those early days like?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, we're from Miami, so we'd go to South Beach when we were younger and try to find ways to get gigs. So we'll go in and we're like, yeah, we got these two black guys want to play violin in your club, you know. There's MySpace, but there's no YouTube, there's no Twitter, there's no other way you could see it. You haven't heard anything like it. So just the idea of, like, two black guys playing violin in a South Beach nightclub sounds ridiculous. But, you know, when they would turn us away, we would just open the trunk of our car right in front of the club, you know, during the day. Promoters and the owners would see us draw a huge crowd because we're just playing, you know, violin on hip-hop stuff, and then they invited us into the clubs, and that's how we honed our style, because the DJs say, yeah, you can play in the club, but you can't make the music stop. So then we would give him a mix that he can play that we've created a, like, kind of a choreographed thing on top of, and the music doesn't stop, except now in the South Beach club, you just start seeing violinists in the distance. You hear the music start being more orchestral, but it's still that, you know, that J-Lo song or that Missy Elliott song or that Jay-Z song, but it's just in a different way. It's just reimagined. And that was how we got our start. It's just, again, thinking about it from a different perspective and how can we be violinists and make money in nightclubs in South Beach and sell people on this idea of these two worlds existing together. And you're going to like it, but, you know, you have to see it and hear it to understand it, kind of thing.
We're talking to Kev Marcus right now, founding member of Black Violin, and he plays violin in that duo. And they're playing at the Widener Center for the Performing Arts in Green Bay this Sunday at 7:30 p.m. And, you know, I trained in classical music, voice, not violin or viola, but when I was starting out, people were not doing the kind of fusion music that you're doing. What was that like? I mean, did you feel like you were having to convince people that, no, I still have my classical chops, but I also have this part of me, and it's okay to bring them together?
I don't know if we had to convince them. And when I was, you know, studying back then, I wasn't really mixing them together yet. Like, we were kind of getting into that in college, but in college I was still just a, you know, scholarship viola student and just, you know, showing up, doing my classes and things of that nature. I think that as time goes, you know, I feel the need to almost validate myself a little bit in the classical world, so I'll jump back into it a little bit and, you know, sit in with an orchestra from time to time. But now, you know, we're able to, like, travel. We performed with the National Symphony Orchestra earlier this year. We played with the Augusta Symphony Orchestra last month. So now it's, like, almost the classical sensibility that we have enough of it where we can bring it into a symphony orchestra, and the members of the symphony orchestra can really appreciate the fusion because we're basically respecting both sides. You know, and that's the whole key to it, is just, you know, having a true respect for both sides and understanding how to mix them together without losing people. that's everything. And it's been working for us, and classical purists seem to really, really like what we're doing.
And a big part of your mission right now is working with kids. You do a lot of educational stuff to bust these stereotypes that we've been talking about what people can do. And, wondering what you want these kids to know about their potential and what people can be.
Yeah, ultimately we use our platform and music as a tool to let kids understand that, you know, first of all, you know, if you want to be a violinist, you know, you do need to practice, but you need to always be thinking about things from a different perspective. And secondly, it's really not even just about music. It's about what is it that you love to do? Because when I perform, I smile 99% of the time, and I love what I do. Now, for a career, I do what I love. And not many people can say that, you know. A lot of listeners probably thinking, oh, tomorrow's Friday, I can't wait because I don't have to go to work this weekend. I don't think that. I think man, I get to play violin every time I go to work. It's great, you know? And so a lot of it, what we try to talk to kids about is not just about music, but about life and about, you know, finding that thing that you love to do, whether it's doctor, lawyer, scientist, you want to be a teacher, you want to be a violinist, whatever. Just, you know, find a different way to do it. You know, if you want to be a basketball player, find a different way to shoot the jumper. If you want to be a football player, you don't have to throw it like Aaron Rodgers. I know he's the best, but there must be different ways to do it. You know, and I think a lot of times we all get caught up in, oh, well, you know, this is the way that everyone's always done it, so I have to do it this way. And we try to just use our music and our message as a way to just break that and have kids thinking outside the box and not sticking to the stereotype of, oh, a violin can only sound like this, or, oh, only a girl can do this kind of thing, or only a boy can do this. Nah, anyone can do anything. Recognize your power. Do what you love. Love what you do. And, you know, and do it, you know, unapologetically. And that's what we're about.
Kev, thank you so much for joining us, and hope you have a great time in Wisconsin.
We plan on it. Thank you, guys. See you soon.
Kev Marcus is a founding member and violin player in the duo Black Violin. They're playing at the Widener Center for the Performing Arts in Green Bay this Sunday at 7:30 p.m.
Coming up, a look at the new GOP health care proposal and the concerns Republican governors and others are raising. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Republicans this week unveiled their long-promised plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. There's a lot riding on this moment for Republicans, as House Speaker Paul Ryan pointed out earlier today.
We as Republicans have been waiting 7 years to do this. This is the closest we will ever get to repealing and replacing Obamacare. The time is here. The time is now. This is the moment, and this is the closest this will ever happen. So we said in 2016 to our citizens, to the American people, to our constituents, if you give us this chance, this opportunity, this is what we will do. Now is our chance and our opportunity to do it.
But not all Republican lawmakers are on board. Several Republican governors have expressed skepticism over the new proposal. Among them, Governor Walker, who calls the GOP plan, quote, a work in progress and hasn't endorsed it so far.
Many of the 33 Republican governors across the nation, particularly those in the Midwest, also feel their input was ignored in the new plan, which is named the American Health Care Act.
Tom Beaumont is with us now. He's national politics reporter for the Associated Press. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. Thanks, Rob.
So in general, why are some Republican governors not completely on board with the GOP's new health care plan?
What the bill would do is it would take Medicaid, which is a program for poor and lower-income Americans, and which was enhanced and increased and expanded under the ACA, under Obamacare, and it would scale it back drastically to cut the cost to the federal government. And what that would do in places like Michigan, Ohio, Iowa, not Wisconsin for a different reason, but in a lot of these upper Midwestern battleground states that chose to expand Medicaid, it would scale that back, and it could leave millions of people now covered by Medicaid without that coverage. It would force these governors to either incur incredible costs to keep the people who are covered by that program still covered, or it would force them to drop them. And that is a huge concern. The House bill, like I said, would curtail costs to Medicaid over time. And, for instance, John Kasich of Ohio is very concerned about that. Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, also very concerned about that. Those two states alone have added about 1.5 million people to their Medicaid rolls since the program went into effect. That's their chief concern, and these governors, a handful of them, are drafting a measure that would compete with the House bill, but it's not clear whether or not that's going to get much or any traction in the Senate yet.
Well, here in Wisconsin, Governor Walker opted not to take the Medicaid expansion money, and part of his reasoning was that it was unreliable, that there could be federal money now, but down the road there wouldn't be, and then what would happen financially here in Wisconsin, which turned out to be kind of prescient, as it turned out, at least if this plan were to go forward. But even with that, he's still not endorsing the GOP plan. What do we know about his concerns?
There's a backstory there for Governor Walker. He is the chairman of the Republican Governors Association, as you know, and he is both trying to work with Congress and be a good partner with Congress, and yet represent his peers who are Republican governors who have these significant concerns about the bill. So he's kind of walking the middle ground right now. Like you said, Wisconsin didn't take the expansion, but as you know, he sought to cover everybody up to 100% of the poverty level. We'll see if that's working. He's argued for block grants, so that states can do what they want to sort of reshape Medicaid. That's still part of what the House bill is talking about. So Governor Walker is, like I said, kind of walking a middle ground, representing the governors, but wanting to be a good partner with the leadership in the House, including his buddy Paul Ryan.
And some other Republican governors have said that they felt left out of the plan, the drafting, and there are other actors on the stage, including some healthcare associations, who say the same thing. How important is it to have the blessing of some of these different factions, the Republicans, the Freedom Caucus, healthcare associations, to getting this bill passed?
Yeah, you said a mouthful. I mean, this policy debate that is going to take place over the next weeks and months is really a pitched battle about the future of the Republican Party. You've got loyal, popular House members in these upper Midwestern battleground states like Michigan's Justin Amash, who are looking at Paul Ryan's plan saying, so you're telling us that it's this, my way or the highway? I don't think so. That's the Freedom Caucus. You've got in the Senate, you've got I wouldn't call them moderates, but maybe more pragmatic members such as Rob Portman of Ohio and Cory Gardner of Colorado, who are saying, what is going to happen to these millions of people now covered by Medicaid? I don't want to say open warfare, because that's kind of a negative term, but everything is on the table right now. Yes, this bill is the bill that everyone's talking about because it's really the only measure out there. But it's not a coincidence that these Republican governors have been trying to push forward their own proposal so that there is something else to talk about. There is going to be a battle in the Senate where you've got people like Rand Paul who are very much against the Ryan bill. But it's these governors who are saying we need to be for something. It's smart for Walker to have allied himself with this group, which he has, though he hasn't, put his seal of approval on the governor's bill, yet he's still encouraging them to go forward. So to answer your question, there are so many different factions that they have to decide what they're going to do. They have to decide somewhat quickly, because before you know it, the midterms are going to be here and these Republicans are going to be held to account.
And again, Paul Ryan saying, this is the moment, this is the window, we have to jump through this opening right now. And here he is explaining a key aspect of the GOP plan as relating to Medicaid.
So what we propose is to modernize the Medicaid program. Modernize the Medicaid program along the lines that we as Republicans have been talking about for years. I think it was Ronald Reagan in like the 70s when he was governor who said the states should take over control of Medicaid.
And what do you make of that clip there from Paul Ryan comparing and likening this moment to Ronald Reagan and again saying that this is the time?
It's really the Republican leadership's attempt to phase out Medicaid as a federal entitlement. Ultimately, a lot of these governors are saying, we need it to remain a federal entitlement. We will maintain control over how it's administered, but you still have to, you, federal government, still need to finance it as part of the agreement as a federal entitlement. However, if you're going to put it in the hands of the states exclusively and eventually scale back the funding for it, you're really shrinking it and eventually trying to eliminate it as a federal entitlement, and apparently hoping or planning that these people who are now covered by that are eventually covered by private insurance. That's really the rub in this whole thing, is what happens to these lower income, in some cases, working lower income people, somewhere between 100 and 138% of the poverty line. I know that's a little bit in the weeds, but this not quite poor enough population is who we're talking about.
We're looking right now at the GOP's new health care plan and some objections to it within the Republican Party. And Tom Beaumont is with us now. He's national politics reporter for the Associated Press, and he's based in Des Moines, Iowa.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your take on this new health care proposal from House Republicans? What aspects of it do you think are good? What are you worried about? Do you think there needs to be another plan? Are there parts of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that you want to keep, get rid of? You can post on the Central Time Facebook page or call in at 800-642-1234.
We're continuing our conversation about the GOP's new health care plan, also called the American Health Care Act.
We want to hear your opinion on that House Republican plan. What do you make of Governor Walker so far? He hasn't denounced the plan or endorsed it, says it's a work in progress. What are your concerns, your hopes for a repeal and replace plan for the Affordable Care Act? What do you hope does happen? What do you hope does not happen? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Tom Beaumont stays with us. He's national politics reporter for the Associated Press based in Des Moines, Iowa. And Tom, you mentioned earlier we were talking about how the Republican Governors Association, led by Governor Walker, working on their own plans, some of them. What do we know about that particular plan and what's in it?
They also would like to retain a lot of the authority on how to enact Medicaid, but what's central to that plan is that the federal government remains a robust financial source for the program. They are very concerned about these, I think it's 11 million people have enrolled in Medicaid under the enhanced Medicaid that was part of the ACA. They're concerned that these people are going to fall off the program or that the states are going to be forced to pick up the tab for them. And so key to that is being able to insure the people that they need to insure. In Governor Kasich's case, he talks about people with mental health issues, mental health problems, mental health illness, and people who are facing addiction problems, that the federal government remains a robust financial partner in this is key to their plan, because they can't do it on their own, plain and simple.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Bob on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Bob, hi.
Hello, thanks for the call. This is a fantasy more than anything, but I would like to see whatever plan these guys come up with be tied directly to the plan that they are getting from the medical care they're getting from themselves. I mean, they set themselves up for this fantastic medical benefits. I would like to see whatever they come up with be their plan.
Bob, thank you for the call. Any thoughts on that, Tom?
That's a common complaint from people who don't want the Affordable Care Act changed, that Congress ought to be bound to whatever rules they make for the rest of the country.
And we were talking just a moment ago about a plan from the Republican Governors Association, some governors involved in drafting that plan you were describing, Tom. And do we know if they're finding any backing there within the Senate for that plan?
It's still early going there. Some of the themes, such as making sure that these 11 million extra people enrolled do not lose their coverage, that is a theme that was expressed in a letter by Ohio Governor Rob Portman and three other Republican senators to Majority Leader Mitch McConnell last week when the draft of the House bill was essentially known. It was a draft back then. It became a bill early this week. But they wrote to McConnell and said, listen, we cannot have people being left in the lurch. So the theme of the Republican governor's draft is at least being given voice in the Senate. And, you know, days, weeks ahead, we will be seeing if some of this language that's in this proposal begins to take shape in the Senate.
Let's take another caller now. We've got Andrew joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
What did you want to add?
I just kind of wanted to. I'm a resident physician at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and I just kind of wanted to add my perspective from, I guess, from the new physician side of it. I feel that some of the big gains that we've made with the Affordable Care Act, despite some of the obvious flaws with costs, are kind of related to allowing kind of the poor and the not quite poor enough to finally have access to health care, and shifting those costs, since there needs to be some shifting in costs to the wealthy. And I feel that the new Republican plan kind of undoes one of the best aspects of the Affordable Care Act, and it shifts the cost from the wealthy back to the poor, and shifts the cost from the young back to the old. And I feel like that's counterintuitive from a kind of social justice equality kind of standpoint. And I feel that it's leaving the vulnerable people in our country kind of out to dry, and giving back millions, billions of dollars to the top 1%.
Andrew, thank you for the call. Appreciate that perspective. And Tom, what do you make of that criticism? We've heard different perspectives on the shifting in the plan of the tax credits from being income-based to being age-based, and the Medicaid we've talked about. So where does Andrew's point there fall in that spectrum?
It's going to be the way in which the success of anything Congress enacts is judged by. Whether it reduces costs, Congress is going to be, you know, up for re-election in now less than 2 years, and whatever they enact, you know, the Republican base expects them to repeal and replace. However, if they repeal and replace, and by, you know, a year or a year and a half from now, costs are still rising, it doesn't appear that they've been stabilized, they face a political backlash. I'm looking at this from a political standpoint, but there's no question, if you look at a map put out by the Kaiser Family Foundation that shows where the tax credits hurt people the most, it's going to be in poor rural America. I mean, they're going to be paying more. There's no question. So maybe they are reducing costs. But they're not reducing costs for the people who need the most help.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I just wanted to say, as a fun fact, that I am a Badger alum, and go Badgers.
Excellent. We're always happy to hear that on Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, that was Tom Beaumont, Badger, also national politics reporter for the Associated Press, talking about Republican opposition to the GOP's new health care proposal.
For children growing up in low-income families, location may have a major impact on their upward mobility. A recent study shows kids in low-income families in Milwaukee can expect to earn 5% less as adults than the family they grew up in. Ross Terrell reports on why the odds of higher earnings are so different in two Wisconsin cities.
Well, my name is Morgan Thomas. I have 4 children, 3 girls and 1 boy.
Thomas has lived in Milwaukee her whole life. She grew up in a stable home with her 6 siblings, but when her mom died while she was in high school, things fell apart. She dropped out of school and saw her modest but steady environment fade away. Now, she's worried that she can't provide the same type of stability for her kids that she once had as a child.
Our family isn't where it's supposed to be right now, so the support system I have is not where I wanted to be at. And my son's father passed away about a year and a half ago due to the violence in Milwaukee.
Thomas lives with her 3-year-old son at the Lodge, a homeless shelter in Milwaukee. She's been there for 3 months and visits her daughters, who live with their dad, whenever she can. Thomas says growing up, she had the chance to play outside without the constant threat of violence. Now that she's a mom, she doesn't think her kids will have that same chance.
Just because you worry about the environment that your children are in, you worry about their safety, you worry about everything.
80 miles west in Madison, the threat of violence isn't as prevalent as it is in Milwaukee. George Hinton is the Social Development Commission's CEO. He says not having to constantly worry about violence in Madison allows there to be more stable neighborhoods.
If you stabilize a neighborhood, you stabilize families not being so transient, because that process in itself impacts the ability to give a child the opportunity to take advantage of the education process.
Hinton says this helps explain why kids in low-income families in Madison can expect to earn 7% more than the families they grow up in, compared to Milwaukee, where kids can expect to earn 5% less than the low-income family they grow up in. Some teens are playing ping pong at an after-school program in Milwaukee run by Wisconsin Community Services Youth Division. Nicole Young Todd is the program administrator. She says they're trying to be a stabilizing force for kids in Milwaukee.
We need to put our money into empowering young people with leadership opportunities, to structured environments, you know, like after school, right after the bell rings, what are you going to do?
Thomas's kids spend time in social programs like these, aimed at giving them something to do in their spare time. She hopes this can help keep her children on track to eventually graduate high school, something Thomas didn't do. She believes that's their key to escaping poverty.
Make sure they graduate out of high school. Make sure that they have a nice job where they're happy and they wake up and like, I'm going to work. This is what I love to do.
To reap those benefits, children need access to high-quality schools that focus on preparing them for college or a career. Mark Levine, a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, says that making sure all kids have that access requires change at the policy level.
We need to, as a community, make a decision that we're going to break down the barriers of segregation. But this is going to be, an important value in the community.
Sometimes in Milwaukee, getting a good education still isn't enough. Levine says Milwaukee's economy hasn't fully rebounded from losing manufacturing jobs more than 30 years ago.
The rate of overall economic growth in the metro area is relatively low compared to other metro areas. Madison has been on a roll for the last 20 or 30 years.
As for Thomas, she is currently pursuing her GED in hopes it will help her provide a stable environment for her kids. She spent all 27 years of her life as a Milwaukee resident, and she says despite the challenges the city presents, she doesn't plan on leaving. Ross Terrell, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, unemployment may be down after the Great Recession, but the people impacted are changing. We look at the new face of unemployment.
Our guest shares her thoughts on the possible impacts in Wisconsin of potential cuts to the National Endowment of the Arts.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.